تمام بشن فلای کشن رستای بود کلیشی مدی وقتی بندشون بکنم کلیش سوالی دی دی گروانی فر چانه اینه سیش سنی مدی فشکتی دی چانه Gyanatamirandasya jana jana salakaya chaksu samilatan jena tasmai sri gurvena maha sri chaitanya manavistam stapitam jena bhutale sayam pakadamayam dadati sakana vansikopratuvyascha kripasindubhavicha patitam pavanevya vajmasya manava Yesterday we heard how Kamsa reacted to the birth of his sister's eighth child, who was foretold that was going to kill him. So he tried to kill that child, but that child was not actually the eighth son of Devaki, the eighth child of Devaki. It was Yogamaya. And that goddess of the material world flew into the sky and chastised Kamsa severely. You rascal! Why are you giving Devaki so much trouble? I'm the child, the death of your life has already been born somewhere else. And when Kamsa saw Durga Devi, the superintending goddess of the material world, that she had flown high in the sky with her eight arms, each holding weapons, he was awestruck for many reasons. First of all, his own sister, in his estimation, had given birth to Durga Devi. This was certainly wonderful. And also, there she was, right before his eyes, chastising him. So when Kamsa recovered, he was repentant, at least for some time. Of course, manaratin asato dhavato vayi, someone whose concept of life is fully selfish, self-centered, really he can't be trusted. Why? Because when he thinks one thing is good for him, he'll do that. And when the mind flips, and the very same thing that he thought was advantageous to his selfish needs, suddenly it becomes inimical to what he likes, then he can kill that very same thing. And then 10 minutes after that, his mind can lament. This is called the riding on the chariot of the mind. Because the mind will carry us to this side and to this side. It will go upside down. It will go positive. It will go negative. And it will go neutral and positive and negative. It can take 5 flips in 7 seconds. So therefore, someone who identifies with his mind, ultimately, he will be untrustworthy because the mind is not under his control. So what he does is not up to him, practically speaking. So Kamsa at this point is feeling very repentant because he had killed 6 of the children prior of Devaki. And he began to beg her pardon and Vasudeva's pardon. He grabbed hold of their feet and begged their forgiveness. And then he began, interestingly enough, preaching some philosophy. So we heard some of the philosophy that Kamsa preached to to Devaki and Vasudev. We heard that yesterday. We've heard the first two or three verses. And one of the verses he explained that everything and everyone is under the control of the Supreme ultimately. Ultimately, we are tiny, we are insignificant. We try to do one thing, we try to do another thing. Even though it makes people feel insecure to accept the reality of their insignificance, their tininess, and it makes them feel very, very threatened to think like that, yet that is reality. Whatever power one has, abilities one has, this is actually a gift of Krishna through the material energy. And just as a gift can be given, it can be taken away. So in this world, everyone is arrogant, actually. Everyone forgets their insignificance. Everyone tries to act as if they were the center of existence. And this is called maya or illusion. Actually, we are tiny. So Kamsa first said, there is no reason to lament that six of your children have been killed already, because ultimately everything is under the Supreme, and if he wants to bring people together, souls together, they come together, and if he wants to sanction the dispersal, then they are dispersed. So do not lament. Good preaching, bad motives. But at this time he seemed quite repentant. And then he gave another example, that the soul is different from the body. So the body must crumble, like it must turn into earth again, like dolls made out of clay. In Bengal especially, one sees this, and also in Vrindavan nowadays, because of all the Bengalis present during the time of Durga Puja, especially in Saraswati Puja. In Vrindavan, they make all these dolls, almost life-size, beautiful dolls of Kali, of Durga, of Saraswati, made out of clay and made out of straw, mixed together, and then they paint them very beautifully. But then, after the ceremonies are finished, the dolls are cast aside, and then they turn back into their elements. So similarly, the bodies are just like dolls or like a clay pot. Each of our bodies is only clay. Earth it is, and to earth it will go. It is made of dust and water and some fire thrown in there and some air. But yet, the soul, like the earth itself, doesn't change. So what then is their need to lament, said Kamsa. This is inevitable, that death overcomes the body of everyone. Everyone. No one is exempt. So here's a second reason that you shouldn't lament, even though your children were killed by me. Everything ultimately is under the Supreme, and ultimately every material body is doomed, even mine. No one likes to think like this, but it's doomed, especially when one's young. One can't even conceive that it's ever going to happen. But youth comes and it goes so quickly. So don't lament, said Kamsa. And then the third reason he gave is that if one is attached to the things of the body, even though he's a soul, he will feel misery when bad things happen to the body, and he will feel elation when good things happen to the body. Just being pushed around by circumstances, his emotions pushed around by circumstances beyond his control, and he becomes attached to good things happening. And as long as one has these type of attachments in the material realm, one will continue his material existence, transmigrating from body to body. The soul will continue that. So don't become attached. So don't lament. And then we'll start today with what Kamsa says in text 21. Another reason why not to lament is this one, and then the next text, 22. This one is from the point of view, if you are a person, a fruitive worker, a karmi, one who is working to gain something within this world. And then the next text will be from the point of view of jnana. And the lesson to be learned from both of these is to not lament. My dear sister Devaki, Kamsa said, all good fortune to you. Everyone suffers and enjoys the result of his own work under the control of providence. Therefore, although your sons have unfortunately been killed by me, please do not lament for them. What can one do ultimately? One cannot fight one's karma. We have a certain amount of pleasure that is due to us and a certain amount of suffering. As no one has to look and to gather his misery, similarly, happiness also comes automatically by the arrangement of the material energy because of one's karma. So Kamsa says, do not lament. These things happen. Unfortunately, it has happened. But everyone ultimately is under the reactions of one's own work, one's own karma. So what is there to lament after? Here is Prabhupada's purport to text 21. As stated in the Brahma Samhita, Yastendra Gopam Matavendram Moho Sakama Bandhanurupam Falam Bhajanamatanoti Karmani Nirdahati Kintuta Bhakti Bhajan Govindamari Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Everyone, beginning from the small insect known as Indra Gopa, up to Indra, the king of the heavenly planets. Everyone is obliged to undergo the results of his fruitive activities. Unavoidable. We may superficially see that one is suffering or enjoying because of some external causes, but the real cause is one's own fruitive activities. The one is now getting the karma or the reactions for things previously done, either in this life or in previous lives. So we think, oh, the reason why I'm getting this is due to my hard work, or this person is the reason why he's getting this is he's born in that family, or he has a particular ability, or he's worked very hard. But actually, these are external reasons. And a more internal reason is his karma. And the most internal, the deepest reason is ultimately this is Krishna's arrangement. So there's different levels of viewing everything. So this is the karma level that Kamsa is speaking. Even more gross than that is the level of I am doing it, I am working. It's because of me that everything is going on. Man is the master of his own, the architect of his fortune. If I work hard enough and if I desire something hard enough, then it must happen. But it really doesn't work like that. There is karma involved. Prabhupada continues, even when someone kills someone else, it is to be understood that the person who was killed met the fruitive results of his own work, and that the man who killed him acted as an agent of the material nature. And the person who acts as an agent of the material nature accrues more karma for his actions. Thus Kamsa begged Devaki's pardon by analyzing the matter deeply. He was not the cause of the death of Devaki's sons. Rather, this was their own destiny. Under the circumstances, Devaki should excuse Kamsa and forget his past deeds without lamentation. Kamsa admitted his own fault, but whatever he had done was done under the control of providence. Kamsa might have been the immediate cause for the death of Devaki's sons, but the remote cause was their past deeds. This was the actual fact. They were actually had been cursed in a previous life to die. They had laughed at a sage, I believe it was Astavakra, man laughed at the funny way he was walking, and he cursed them. Why? There is no other explanation for why someone is born in one family with the proverbial golden spoon in his mouth, everything automatically, wealth, beauty, everything, just intelligence, just is just there for his, it's just there for him. Education. And another person just has to struggle and struggle and struggle. Nothing comes to him. Struggling, working, only bad luck. And then his life just changes at some point too. And that can happen. And suddenly, yes, finally. But this is just karma that's coming. There is no other explanation from it. It's not the work that one does. Because there are so many people working like dogs who are poor. And it is not some god up there. And if someone has prayed nicely, he gives, you know, he sprinkles some gold dust on that person. And this person he's angry at, or he likes this person, so some gold comes to him. And then this person he's angry at, and thunderbolt. I saw one time a cartoon of this. There was God, like an old man with a beard, naturally, and he's sitting in front of his computer, and you see, and on the screen there's a person walking along down the road, and there's a piano being held by a rope, and the man's walking on the piano, and God's about to push the enter key on there, as if this is what he's doing. He's the supreme controller, and he's like just. It's like playing some kind of a silly game, you know, giving this person trouble. Today you're going to drown. And you, today you're going to walk down the street and find the wallet with $100,000 in it. And the lottery, this one will win the lottery. You're not going to win the lottery. Who would want to worship such a peculiar God like that? Today you're going to die. Why? I don't know. Because I feel like it. I'm God. I can do what I like. So karma is very powerful. Very powerful. It is not work, one's own work, that is all powerful. Karma is so powerful. But ultimately it's not karma. Karma is the remote cause, but not the ultimate cause. The ultimate cause is Krishna. Ultimately the cause of everything. Sarva karana karanam. If one traces everything back to its origin, one will find Krishna. The next text. So that was from the point of view of karma. They must have done something to have given them this result of being killed, even though it was by me. Text 22. In the bodily conception of life, one remains in darkness without self-knowledge, thinking I am being killed, or I have killed my enemies. As long as a foolish person thus considers the self to be the killer or the killed, he continues to be responsible for material obligations, and consequently he suffers the reactions of happiness and distress. So here he's taking the same truth that they shouldn't lament from the point of view of jnana or knowledge. Ultimately he's explaining you're a soul, you're eternal. Krishna explains the same thing in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. No one can kill anyone else because the soul is eternal. You cannot be the killer, nor can you be the killed, because the soul is eternal. How can anyone kill something that can never be killed? But if a person thinks otherwise, kartaham iti manyate, thinking I'm the one who's acting, he becomes entangled in the reactions of everything that he does. So this is some knowledge thrown in. Not the ultimate knowledge, but knowledge. Prabhupada's purport. By the grace of the Lord, Kamsa felt sincere regret for having unnecessarily persecuted such Vaishnavas as Devaki and Vasudev. Because I'm situated on the platform of knowledge, Kamsa said, understanding that I am not at all the killer of your sons, I have no responsibility for their death. As long as I thought that I would be killed by your son, I was ignorant. I was in ignorance. But now I am freed from this ignorance, which was due to a bodily concept of life, and therefore I am beyond the bodily concept of life, and therefore how could I be accused of killing anyone? And since I'm beyond the bodily concept of life, I don't become entangled in the reactions of even what I have done. Therefore, what is the use of becoming angry at me? You'll get entangled, but I won't. I have knowledge. But he wasn't speaking so grossly as that. But the idea is that one who knows that he is not the actor, the doer in the material world, that the three modes of material nature are acting, the forces of the material world, pushing, pulling, he doesn't become entangled. If his consciousness is actually like that, he doesn't become entangled. There's no karma attached because he has no false ego. Even if killing in this world. Purport. By the grace of the Lord, Kamsa felt sincere regret. Because I'm situated on the platform of knowledge, Kamsa said, understanding that I'm not at all the killer of your sons, I have no responsibility for their deaths. Yasya nahan krito bhava bhudir yasya nalipyate hatva pisa imalokan nahanti na nabadyate. One who is not motivated by false ego, whose intelligence is not entangled, though he kills men in this world, is not the slayer, nor is he bound by his actions. According to this axiomatic truth, Kamsa pleaded that he was not responsible for having killed the sons of Devaki and Vasudev. Please try to excuse me for such false external activities, he said, and be pacified with this same knowledge. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on text 21. Short comments here. Kamsa continues, this was the from the point of view of karma. The sons killed by me are sons from the external point of view due to bodily identification. Therefore do not grieve. I have only killed the bodies of your sons, so I should not be blamed. If you say I do not have such knowledge of the soul, then still you should not grieve. According to the view of the Karmavadis, fruit of workers, taking shelter of ignorance, all souls are forced to experience the result of their actions, even though they do not desire it. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's comment on the verse we just read, even still shorter. From the viewpoint of a jnani, Kamsa tries to show that he is not the killer of her sons. The ignorant see only the body, and they do not see the soul. Since I do not identify with the body, I incur no sin, nor get any bondage of karma for killing the children. This is the vulture speaking philosophy. Kamsa begged, text 23, my dear sister and brother-in-law, please be merciful to such a poor-hearted soul as me, since both of you are saintly persons. Please excuse my atrocities. Having said this, Kamsa fell at the feet of Vasudeva and Devaki. He was holding their feet, begging them for forgiveness. His eyes were full of tears of regret. Prabhupada's short purport. Although Kamsa had spoken very nicely on the subject of real knowledge, his past deeds were abominable and atrocious. And therefore he further begged forgiveness from his sister and brother-in-law by falling at their feet and admitting that he was a most sinful person. 24. Fully believing in the words of the goddess Durga, Kamsa exhibited his familial affection for Devaki and Vasudev by immediately releasing them from their iron shackles. Because Durga Devi had said, the child that will kill you has already been born in another place. Why give trouble to Devaki, your sister? She is so innocent. So he believed those words and he released Vasudeva and Devaki. What is there to fear from them any longer? There's nothing to fear. I am so sorry for it. When Devaki saw her brother actually repentant while explaining ordained events, preordained, this was karma. She was relieved of all anger. Similarly, Vasudeva was also free from anger. Smiling, he spoke to Kamsa as follows. Here's the purport to 25. And then 26 and 27, Vasudeva will respond with some philosophy also. But first 25. Devaki and Vasudeva, both highly elevated personalities, accepted the truth presented by Kamsa that everything is ordained by providence. According to the prophecy, Kamsa would be killed by the eighth child of Devaki. Therefore, Vasudeva and Devaki saw that behind all these incidents was a great plan devised by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because the Lord had already taken birth just like a human child and was in the safe custody of Yasoda, everything was happening according to plan and there was no need to continue their ill feeling towards Kamsa. Thus they accepted Kamsa's words. So they saw that although Kamsa had apparently interfered with their lives, Kamsa's words were nevertheless true. He had ruined their lives on one level, but what can one do? Being strong. And since they saw, that was the level that Kamsa was speaking on, but they saw something deeper. They saw that Krishna has a plan here. So in the face of Krishna's plan, even if we see that a person, someone, has for his own poor motives, with terrible motives, he has somehow cooperated with Krishna's plan, how can one actually be angry with that person? This is very high consciousness, actually. One who can maintain this consciousness, not sentimentally, but regardless of what's happening, be fully, faithfully trusting that he is in the hands of Krishna, in the hands of God, in the hands of much deeper than the external events that are going on. Such a person naturally inherits the kingdom of God. But who will have such deep, pure, forceful Krishna consciousness? And for such a person, there is no anxiety. No anxiety, because whatever is happening externally, internally he's living in his relationship with Krishna. And because he is a devotee of Krishna, he is always secure. Now, Vasudeva, he gave up his... the words in the verse were rusha. Rusha, cha. Rusha means anger. And cha means and other things, etc. So he gave up, Vasudeva and Devaki gave up the anger and their lamentation. Something that's due to happen, it must happen. What is the use of lamenting? But now in two verses, 26 and 27, Vasudeva will speak. O great personality Kamsa, only by the influence of ignorance does one accept the material body and bodily ego. What you have said about this philosophy is correct. Persons in the bodily concept of life, lacking self-realization, differentiate in terms of this is mine and this belongs to another. So he spoke in Vasudeva speaking both on the karma platform and the jnana platform here. Persons with the vision of differentiation are imbued. So if one is thinking, if one doesn't understand one's own identity, and one's mood is to accumulate more and more on the material level, Vasudeva is now going to say the result of that mentality. Persons with this vision of differentiation, oh, this is mine, aham ameti, the body is mine, whatever I can grab is mine for my selfish pleasure, enjoyment. Such persons are imbued with the material qualities of lamentation, jubilation, fear, envy, greed, illusion, and madness. This is the result of the bodily concept of life, being immersed in that. They are influenced by the immediate cause, which they are busy counteracting because they have no knowledge of the remote supreme cause, the personality of Godhead. That is beyond their vision. So, three different levels of consciousness are really explained here. One is the person who's just acting, influenced by lust, anger, greed, I want, envy, hatred, aversion, ichchadvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata. Another level, a person who understands nothing is his, he's an eternal soul, these things are of the body of this material world, and one is gaining and losing according to one's karma. And the third level is that everything is ultimately in the hands of Krishna. Karma, Gyan, Bhakti. Prabhupada's short purports. Everything is done automatically by the influence, by the laws of nature, which work under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is no question of doing anything independently, for one who has put himself in this material atmosphere is fully under the control of nature's laws. Our main business, therefore, should be to get out of this conditional life and become again situated in spiritual existence. This is the purpose of life. And the Prabhupada's message here is that people should take their life seriously. What is the actual purpose of life? And here he states, it is to get out of material existence, material identification with the body, and to get it free from ignorance. Tamasi ma jyoti gama, and come out to knowledge, to the light of understanding one's relationship with God. Only due to ignorance does a person think, I'm a demigod, I'm a human being, I'm a dog, I'm a cat. Or when the ignorance is still further advanced, I am God. Everyone is God. Unless one is fully self-realized, one's life of ignorance will continue. Text 27, the purport to that second verse. Krishna is the cause of all causes, sarvakarana karanam. But one who has no connection with Krishna is disturbed by immediate causes and cannot restrain his vision of separateness or separation or differences. When an expert physician treats a patient, he tries to find the original cause of the disease and is not diverted by the symptoms of that original cause. Similarly, a devotee is never disturbed by reverses in life. When sometimes one feels a pain in one's neck, and if one goes to a doctor, an expert doctor, they'll say, oh, the cause is somewhere else, it's over here, and the pain is referred pain. But here is the original cause. Don't treat just the symptom. So there are so many levels of causes. There's the immediate cause, there's the remote cause, but then there is the ultimate cause, the cause of the actual disease, the cause of the bodily concept of life, the cause of our being in material existence, the cause of illusion. Krishna Mule se jeev anadya bahyamu gatte eva maya tare samsareda duk. We have turned our back on Krishna. And the cure is to turn towards Krishna. So that's the original cause, that Krishna and one's karma, but ultimately Krishna is there in everything that occurs. Tateinu kampamsu samikshamano. A devotee understands that when he is in distress, this is due to his own past misdeeds, which are now accruing reactions. Although by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, these are only very slight. Karmani near the hatikintu tabakti bhajam. When a devotee under the protection of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is to suffer because of faults in his past deeds, he passes through only a little misery by the grace of the Lord. Although the disease of a devotee is due to mistakes committed sometimes in the past, he agrees to suffer and tolerate such miseries, and he depends fully on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, he is never affected by material conditions or lamentation, jubilation, fear, and so on. A devotee never sees anything to be unconnected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is a devotee. For one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost to such a person, nor is he ever lost to me, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. See Krishna in everything. Sukadeva Goswami continued. So Vasudeva replied to Kamsa's prayers. Vasudeva and Devaki were now free. And Sukadeva Goswami, who was narrating this to Maharaj Prakrit, he says, continues speaking. Thus, having been addressed in purity by Devaki and Vasudeva, who were very much appeased, Kamsa felt pleased. And with their permission, he entered his home. After that night had passed, Kamsa summoned his ministers and informed them of all that had been spoken by Yogamaya, who had revealed that he who was to slay Kamsa had already been born somewhere else. After hearing their master's statements, the envious advisors, asuras, who were enemies of the demigods and who were not very expert in their dealings, advised Kamsa as follows. Because the demigods, they had predicted, or there was a voice that had predicted that the eighth child of Devaki will kill, and now it's not true. And then the demigoddess Durga Devi had come to thwart Kamsa's killing the eighth son of Vasudeva and Devaki, saying that the child had been born somewhere else. So Kamsa was feeling satisfied, but the demons, the asuras, who were his advisors, they turned his mind around. So even if one has knowledge, if one associates with people who are materialistic, one's consciousness must be turned around by that association. A satsanga tyaga, e vaishnava char. One time in a meeting in Melbourne, after the meeting, Prabhupada was asked, how does one become sincere? In the Melbourne Town Hall. And Prabhupada's reply was, how does one become a drunkard? If one wants to become a drunkard and learn the fine art of drinking alcohol, all one has to do is associate, hang out in the pubs, and make good friends with people who are drunkards. And then very quickly you will learn this, and you'll be drinking away, and etc., etc., and you'll be able to distinguish between this year's wine and that year's wine, which is the good one and which is the bad one. It's all a matter of association. So Prabhupada wasn't recommending to learn sincerity, one goes to the pub, the bar. But he was saying it all depends on association. So one must associate with sincere souls. This is the key. To not associate with materialistic people, because one will, just like if one associates with people who are always coughing and sneezing with the flu or this or that, one, it's just a matter of time before one catches it too. So similarly, if one associates with people who have specific material desires, those desires will be transferred into our hearts. And if one, on the other hand, associates with people of spiritual desires sincerely, those desires will come to our heart. So this is the art, sadhu sangha. Lava matra saru sange sarva siddhi hoy. This brings all perfection. So Kamsa, although he had knowledge, he had bad friends who were arrogant, who were hateful of the godly, and they began to preach to him what he should do. They had a better idea than he had. They had a big plan, and listen to what it was. If this is so, O king of the Bhoja dynasty, that the death of your life has previously been born, beginning today, we shall kill all the children born in the villages, towns, and pasturing grounds within the past 10 days or slightly more. Don't be satisfied that your death has been born somewhere else. Start killing every child now. The demigods always fear the sound of your bowstring. They are constantly in anxiety, afraid of fighting. Therefore, what can they do by their endeavors to harm you? While being pierced by your arrows, which you discharged on all sides, some of them, who were injured by the multitude of arrows, but who desired to live, fled the battlefield, intent on escaping. Defeated and bereft of all weapons, some of the demigods gave up fighting and praised you with folded hands, and some of them, appearing before you with loosened garments and hair, said, O Lord, we are very much afraid of you. You are so powerful. You should use your power to protect yourself. When the demigods were bereft of their chariots, when they forget how to use weapons, or they are fearful or attached to something other than fighting, when their bows are broken and they have thus lost the ability to fight, your majesty does not kill them. But now, they're explaining, you should not follow the etiquettes of warfare. Now is not the time for that. This is an emergency. You have to save your life. Even though you're such an honorable and powerful person, now you must kill all the children who have taken their birth. Thus they advise Kamsa to give up traditional etiquette in fighting and chastise the enemy at any cost, because your life is at stake. 36. The demigods boast uselessly while away from the battlefield. Only where there is no fighting can they show their prowess. Therefore, from such demigods we have nothing to fear. As for Lord Vishnu, he is in seclusion in the core of the hearts of the yogis. As for Lord Shiva, he has gone to the forest. And as for Lord Brahma, he is always engaged in austerities and meditation. The other demigods, headed by Indra, are devoid of prowess. Therefore, you have nothing to fear. Nevertheless, even though you have nothing to fear, because of their enmity, our opinion is that the demigods should not be neglected, because they said they have nothing to fear. So they've come on one side. You have nothing to fear. You are so powerful. They're building him up on one side. They're flattering him to get him to do what they want. On one side, you are so powerful. You have nothing to fear for them. Then why kill? But yet they say, because of their enmity, our opinion is that the demigods should not be neglected. Therefore, to uproot them completely, engage us in fighting with them, if we are ready to follow you. As a disease, if initially neglected, becomes acute and impossible to cure, or as the senses, if not controlled at first, are impossible to control later, an enemy, if neglected in the beginning, later becomes insurmountable. Prabhupada's purport to 37, he says, according to moral instructions, one should not neglect to extinguish fire completely, to treat diseases completely, and clear debts completely. Otherwise, they will increase and later be difficult to stop. Therefore, the ministers advise Kamsa to uproot his enemies completely. Here's the rest of their plan. Mulam hi Vishnur Devanam. Mulam means the root. Prabhupada translates as the foundation. The foundation of all the demigods is Lord Vishnu, who lives and is worshipped wherever there are religious principles, traditional culture, the Vedas, cows, Brahmins, austerities, and sacrifices with proper remuneration. O King, we who are your adherents in all respects shall therefore kill the Vedic Brahmanas, the persons engaged in offering sacrifices and austerities, and the cows that supply milk from which clarified butter is obtained for the ingredients of sacrifices. So everything that supports religiosity and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then who we have to fear? The good get their power from religious activities. Vishnu is dependent on sacrifices. Sacrifices are dependent on Brahmins. Brahmins are dependent on to perform the sacrifice on the ghee. The ghee comes from cows, so we'll kill the cows, we'll kill the Brahmins, we'll stop the sacrifices. And in this way, the demigods get their power from Vishnu. Vishnu will become powerless. And in this way, the demigods or enemies will be dead, practically speaking. They'll be easy for us to destroy. Everything godly will destroy. And this is contemporary civilization, basically. And Prabhupada explains in his purport. How can envious persons be happy in their godless civilization? No one is happy. People's happiness is making others envious of them, thinking, oh, look what he has. He must be happy because I'm not happy. He has something that I want. He must be happy. And that's the pleasure of the person who has it, who's driving around in the fast car, has the swimming pool, the this, the that, the fancy this and the fancy that. Just other people will think, oh, look what he has, only if I. So how can an envious person be happy in the godless civilization? The Supreme Personality of Godhead punishes them by keeping them in darkness, birth after birth, and pushing them lower and lower into wretched conditions of hellish life. The Krishna consciousness movement has started a Brahminical civilization, but especially when it is introduced in the Western countries, the asuras or the demonic try to impede it in many ways. Nonetheless, we must push forward this movement tolerantly for the benefit of human society. Lord Vishnu comes, advisors continued, the super soul within the core of everyone's heart is the ultimate enemy of the asuras and is therefore known as Asuradvit. He is the leader of all the demigods because all the demigods, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, exist under his protection. The great saintly persons, sages, and Vaishnavas also depend on him. To persecute the Vaishnavas, therefore, is the only way to kill Vishnu. Prabhupada's purport. It's a little bit left. The demigods and the Vaishnavas especially are part and parcel of the Supreme Lord Vishnu because they are always obedient to his orders. The demoniac followers of Kamsa thought that if the Vaishnavas, saintly persons and sages were persecuted, the original body of Vishnu would naturally be destroyed. Thus they decided to suppress Vaishnavism. The Asuras perpetually struggle to persecute the Vaishnavas because they do not want Vaishnavism to spread. Vaishnavas preach only devotional service, not encouraging karmis, jnanis, and yogis, because if one must liberate oneself from material conditioned life, one must ultimately become a Vaishnava. Our Krishna consciousness movement is directed with this understanding, and therefore the Asuras always try to suppress it. Sukadeva Goswami continued, thus having considered the instructions of his bad ministers, Kamsa, who is bound by the laws of Yamaraj, in other words, he was going to die, and devoid of good intelligence because he was a demon, decided to persecute the saintly persons, the Brahmins, as the only way to achieve his own good fortune. These demons, the followers of Kamsa, were expert at persecuting others, especially the Vaishnavas, and could assume any form they desired. After giving these demons permission to go everywhere and persecute the saintly persons, Kamsa entered his palace. So they gave so much trouble. So these are the demons who ended up taking the forms that would enter Vrindavan and kill and make their attempts to kill Krishna. And of course they themselves were killed. So charged with passion and ignorance and not knowing what was good or bad for them, the Asuras, for whom impending death was waiting, began the persecution of the saintly persons. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that hearing how the demons were so inspired to cause so much harm to the devotees and even attempt to kill Krishna, he saw, Sukadeva Goswami saw, that Maharaj Prickett was getting in anxiety. This is the fear of a devotee, that other devotees will become harmed in some way. So therefore, Sukadeva Goswami in this verse, in text 45, he said, for them, the Asuras, for whom impending death was waiting. In other words, he's telling them, Arad Agata Mityava, they will soon die. So therefore, Maharaj Prickett, his anxiety will go away. And the final text. My dear king, when a man persecutes great souls, confirming this fact, all his benedictions of longevity, beauty, fame, religion, blessings, and promotion to higher planets will be destroyed. That's in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 10th canto, 4th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Atrocities of King Kamsa. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Jaya Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhaktivedanta ki jai. Any quick questions?
Okay. Yeah. I'm quoting the Bhagavatam. Talking about the Asuras trying to destroy saintly persons, we see factually in the history of human society the last 1,000 years that many times governments have been able to squash religion, destroy the medieval class, take away the priest's property. So how does that fit into the idea of protecting the life?
But if you talk about Christianity, for example, it's a complicated subject because different churches, and certainly not only Christianity, but churches and institutions very often become corrupt, and therefore they no longer represent, they represent, but there is a mixture of material motives in there, and therefore that makes everything very confusing. But take it back to its origin. Jesus, he was killed for what purpose? To stop his preaching. And did it stop his preaching? Did it stop him? No. His whatever message he gave was spread very much because of that, practically speaking. We see, and then right after that, all the apostles, they were killed also. But that doesn't stop religion or word of God from spreading. Even in Krishna consciousness, look what happened in Russia. Back in the 70s, they persecuted the devotees so terribly, so terribly, tortured them, shock treatments and things like that. And the result was that Krishna consciousness spread so deeply, incredibly deeply. So for a devotee who is being persecuted and given difficulty, He trusts that Krishna is going to care for him. Swarga prabhagana rakeshu apitu yata darshana. He sees Krishna's hand in everything. And even if someone is killed, actually killed, he, like happened to Chitraketu when he took the form of who? Vishwasura. That was actually Krishna's plan, as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, to bring this great soul to the spiritual world even quicker. He could not tolerate his separation, being separated from him. So only by trusting Krishna's mercy that it's within every situation can one actually be peaceful in this world.
In the case of Russia, some of the early devotees were put in concentration camps, given medication, and lost it psychophysically as a result.
So why did that happen, are you asking? Or how was Krishna's protection?
Even in this colony, when Prabhupada was there, they started to center in Tehran, but then when they had the revolution, there was that revolution. They tried to center in Iskcon Thakur, but he's never been back there.
No, it's very, it's kind of, Krishna consciousness is very strong. It's half underground, half overground. The government knows about it, and they don't bother the devotees. But in fact, in Vrindavan, there were five came to the retreat we had at Govardhan. But Krishna's plan is very, it's not always easy to understand. But this is what it means to be a devotee, in fact. It means to trust that Krishna's plan is working, despite temporary reverses. This is practically what it means. So one's faith has to be very, very, very deep to be a devotee. One has to be a deep devotee. Superficialities won't work. And certainly we're all going to need that type of faith at the time of death. That I am in Krishna's hands. And one has to give oneself up to Krishna's hands and give up his attachment to and fears of losing control and place himself under Krishna's control. Ultimately, the material body must die. But a devotee, one who is actually a devotee, he fixes his consciousness with great faith on Krishna, and then he transcends the death of the body. That is the worst thing that can happen, say. But we see the example of Dhruva Maharaj. He stepped upon the head of death. That means that he used death as a stepping stone to go to the spiritual world. It was an assistant that helped him to go to the spiritual world. But who has that kind of faith? So therefore, there's a Bengali proverb, I don't know the proverb, but one's bhajan, how much one is a devotee, will be tested at the time of his death. We may put on a good show, be able to give a good class, this, that. But the real test will be how much one can adhere with fixed consciousness to the lotus feet of Krishna at the time of death. So for such a person, there's nothing... Someone who is a real devotee, there's nothing that can go wrong for him. Nothing can go wrong for him. So the thing is, of course, that we have to use our life to become devotees. This question is a... Go ahead.
The idea that materialists can inflict terrible suffering on the world is because that mentality comes, so that's sometimes there.
But that's what Prabhupada speaks about, that.
Or sanctuary temples, kill so many Brahmins.
And then in the long run, what happened? Krishna consciousness is spreading all over the world very strongly. So there's two levels. One is to stop the religiosity. So that is what we spoke about mostly just now. That it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And the other level is harm to individuals. And if the individual is fixed in his devotion, there may be external, superficial harm to such a person, but he uses that to step forward to the spiritual world. So there's two different levels there. So which level would you like to talk about? And then there's the plan. We tend to see the plan, Krishna's plan, in a frame of reference of 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 7 years or 10 years. But how many years did it take, for example, Lord Chaitanya predicted, made his prediction 500 years ago, and then it took 500 years for Prabhupada to actually spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world. So our frame of reference is 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, 12 years, 15 years, 25 years. But Krishna's frame of reference is how long? It's very long. So sometimes, because we can say that Krishna consciousness spread throughout the world in 10, 12 years, right? Or you could say it spread throughout the world in 510 years, depending upon your frame of reference that you want to look at it in. So we only get a part of the plan. And we get, if we're fortunate, we get the service that we perform in, within that plan. And if we can do that well, that's all we can ask for. We can't know the whole thing, what's going to happen exactly in the next 10,000 years. Who would have suspected that when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave Prabhupada initiation and called him Abhaya Charanam Vinda, that he would be the one to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world? Who would have known that was part of the plan? So it's hard to say. We can't say. We just... Are you satisfied? Or?
Yeah, it's a partial answer.
Huh?
It's probably a full answer, but I haven't fully realized
well,
the answer.
Well, what's more of the question then? Why does Krishna allow it?
I guess I get back to the whole question of letting everybody's experience in the material world. It's so, often cases it's so awful.
Yeah.
But it can be difficult to reconcile
why things happen.
With the all-loving God.
Well, that's okay. That's perhaps a different question.
Yeah, and then even specifically.
But that's a very, you know. But for none of us.
It's a short time, but 5, 10 years, 10 years. But if you're actually in a situation, say you're a devotee put in a concentration camp for 10 years, it would be an extraordinarily long time.
Yeah.
It'd be an extraordinarily long time to.
Yes. It would seem like that. But Krishna also explains many, many births both you and I have passed and I can remember them and you cannot. So a devotee really does want to keep his frame of reference bigger than 5 years or 2 years or 10 years. Therefore, in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, the calculation of the time from the Adam chapter describes that the life of Lord Brahma is like a flash, which is indeterminably long. It's like a flash of lightning over the ocean. That's such a long time. So, if we have a big perspective, if we view things from Krishna's point of view, from the point of view of eternity, then we'll become more tolerant about the difficulties and the glories of the things that happen to us in a day. That's what knowledge means. And therefore knowledge must make one tolerant. So if we want to understand it using the same consciousness, material consciousness, then it just doesn't work. It's not understandable. But if we use the words that Krishna explains to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter, he calls Arjuna fool because he's looking at things only from a bodily, physical, temporal point of view. So because we have that consciousness, we have to understand that we have to elevate our consciousness. We have to focus on our attention. But then again, the question of, you know, why has God done all this to everyone? That's a different question, and we'll have to leave that for another day. You know, these are the heavy questions that are in the Western psyche. Yeah. Because it leads one, if one asks that question, you know, then the next thing is, well, either he can't do anything about it, which makes him not all-powerful, or he really likes to see people suffer, so it makes him not very nice person like that. So therefore, from my looking at Western philosophy, with theology, they're always trying to continuously figure out, well, does God really exist or not? Look at the mess the world is in. Is he really there? How could he possibly be doing this to everyone? So that's trying to, and it's going to get even worse in Kali Yuga, because Kali Yuga is going to get worse because people are acting worse and worse and worse, and the karma keeps increasing. So that worse things are going to happen, terrible things are going to be increasing, and therefore the people's atheism is going to be increasing for that. But that's trying to understand God through a very materialistic mind. A selfish and self-centered mind. And in the Bhagavad Gita it explains very clearly, and we can talk about this point if you like at some point, that it is not, Krishna is just the sanctioner. He sets up the laws of the material energy, and the blaming God for the cruelty in this world is like blaming the judge, the criminals blaming the judge for being sent to prison and having to undergo terrible things in prison, restricted freedom, etc., etc., solitary confinement, etc., etc. But is it the judge's fault, or is it the prisoner's fault? There's so much animal slaughter. Every child, they have to be trained to eat meat, practically speaking. It's so unnatural. Every child, let the child have its own little sheep or cow or something, and their own pet little sheep, and kill it and then eat it. No one can do it. Everyone knows it's cruel. Everyone knows it's horrible. No one can say, I don't know. Everyone knows it's horrible. And still they do it. So religious people are such killers of animals, and still they think they're religious. They don't know that to cause another pain is bad, and they think that there's no reaction to that. And then they say, why is God doing this to me? Why are you killing? Give up killing. Heartless. Because of their sinful activities, their hearts have become so hard they don't even notice. I like my spare ribs well done. I like my chicken breasts without bones. Take out the bones from the fish. Oh, these people. Pickled tongue. Oh, golly gee. How would you like it if... I'm sorry, give me a heart. It's disgusting. It's disgraceful. And people wonder, and then they say, oh, why is God doing this to me? I'm such a good person. I've caused so much trouble to others in this life. I've cheated. I've done everything. I've exploited. I've been completely selfish. Yeah, go ahead.
Is a question?
Yeah, sure.
I think in the discourse you mentioned three different types of materialist mind, a jhani and a bhakti.
Yeah, a materialist, a karmi, and a jnani, and a devotee.
Yes,
yeah.
The jhani can have intellectual knowledge that,
yes,
I'm not going to die or whatever.
Yes.
But that's not really going to help you unless you are a bhakti.
Truly, if
he, true experiences him.
If one actually has knowledge that he's an eternal soul, that will help him.
To some degree,
but one needs some bhakti, some devotion to even attain that knowledge. Some devotion is required to even attain that knowledge. Yeah, because there's an arrogance because the people who understand their souls, and that's the limit of their knowledge, they think their realization generally is that ultimately I am the supreme. And I will. And in Perth, you hear every person who has any inkling of either Indian philosophy or did some New Age meditation or anything, everyone says we're all the supreme, we're all God. Buddhists, Advaita Gyan, you know, meditators. This is everyone's goal to become. That is arrogant, if you think about it. Anything, even being a spiritualist, a religionist, anything but be a surrendered servant of God. I'll even be a religionist, a spiritualist, but I want to become God. Anything but become a servant of God. That's bhakti. And where Krishna consciousness, it explains very much details about who Krishna God is, so that one can develop an attraction to him. So being a servant of God will seem like the most wonderful thing, because it's not just a servant, it's a loving servant. Seva is the Sanskrit word, a sevite, sevak. That one who is serving out of his great loving devotion, because Krishna God is all attractive. He is all beautiful. He's a person, a supreme person, all-powerful person, not a person like me who is so limited and finite.
So how much is the devotion dependent on the direct experience of Krishna compared to having like an intellectual knowledge and reading books and stuff?
But in naturally, as one reads, as one hears, as one chants, as one associates with devotees, one's experience increases, one's faith increases, one's knowledge increases. So it's sort of each one increases the other. The experience increases one's faith increases one's realization increases one's knowledge increases one's faith, experience, you know. And it will continue if one doesn't make any great blunders. It will just each will help the other. But naturally, of course, we want the experience. We just don't want to theoretically say it's true. Naturally, prema pramoto mahan. That means that the goal is love. The topmost goal is love for Krishna. Prema bhakti. That's the topmost goal. So love is it's the soul's natural existence, practically speaking, which is an experience, a transcendental experience of himself as a lover of Krishna. Because now when we think of who I am, who myself is, what do I think of? I think of I'm this, you know, I'm strong, I'm white, I'm male, I'm this, I'm that, I'm 57, I'm a drummer, you know, so many different concepts of who I am. But when the soul is pure, his self-concept is, I am Krishna's, and Krishna is mine. Not just a sentiment, but a full experience of his self-identity is that. So the jnani at best can experience himself as eternal. So the part that's missing is I'm eternally Krishna's, and Krishna is eternally mine. So eternal is part. But what is the nature of the existence of that, of myself in eternity? That's what Krishna consciousness teaches. That is the gift of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But because it's getting late, we should stop now. Thank you. Good questions. Also, I mean, those questions are, you know, very deep questions, you know, that sit around in the mind as doubts for long, 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 long times. For a long time. You know, how could Krishna let all these crazy things happen? I also wonder a lot of the times.
When you were talking about the man walking on the street about
to get
the piano
on
the table,
yeah.
I can't trigger the
button. I have that cartoon. Someone sent it to me. But
he's in a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
Oh, well, if you get hit on the head with a piano, it hurts. But that's not God. As if he doesn't have anything better to do. He's the supreme, all-powerful, all-knowing controller.